I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, President Trump's record on race. In Kenansville, North Carolina, in September of 2016, Trump declared that black communities in the U.S. are, quote, absolutely in the worst shape that they've ever been in before. Well, ignoring the president's apparent ignorance of slavery and Jim Crow, Trump's basic pitch to African-American voters came down to a phrase that Juan Williams of Fox News appropriates in the title of his new book, What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? Trump's War on Civil Rights. Williams examines Mr. Trump's racial belligerence, from his response to the white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, to his contention that undocumented immigrants voted by the millions in the election. Juan Williams joins me for the hour when Midday starts right after the news. And good afternoon. Thanks, Andy, and thanks again to everybody who has contributed so far in this fall membership campaign. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. I am joined today by Juan Williams. He's the co-host of The Five and a political analyst on Fox News. He's also the author of many books, the latest of which makes the case that President Donald Trump willfully ignores the progress in civil rights that has occurred in America during the last 50 years, and that Mr. Trump harbors deep-seated, long-standing resentment against people of color. The book is called What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? Trump's War on Civil Rights. It was published yesterday, and Juan Williams joins us today from the studios of WABE in Atlanta. Juan Williams, welcome to the show. Thanks for your time.
Tom, it's a pleasure to be with you.
So, since really the day Mr. Trump announced for president, coming down that escalator in Trump Tower back in 2015, people have been writing about his, at the very least, racial insensitivity to his outright blatant racism. What do you hope to do with this particular book? What is your aspiration with this book in, you know, sort of going through something of a laundry list of the areas that Mr. Trump has had an effect? Voting rights, education, public accommodations, equal rights, employment, and housing. What do you hope to achieve?
Well, you know, so all those provisions that you just ran through, Tom, are in fact sections of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So what I'm doing is trying to get behind the static. The static is all the statements that Trump makes about race, whether he calls Omarosa a dog, says Maxine Waters is low intelligence, says that, you know, LeBron James is so dumb that he makes Don Lemon look smart. I could go on. Of course, I mean, he also says things like, you know, those people coming from Africa and Latin America, the Caribbean, coming from S-hole countries, it just doesn't stop. And even in the introduction that you offered, you forget that even before he ran for office, before the escalator and the, you know, the demonization of Mexicans as rapists and criminals, he was involved with claiming that President Obama was not an American, that in fact he was lying, the president, and had been born elsewhere. This effort by Trump, which went on for years, is called the Birther Movement, and it persuaded, I hesitate when I say it in the past tense, Tom, because even today, a majority of self-identified Republicans don't think that Barack Obama was born in the United States, despite all the evidence to the contrary. So this is Trump's record. This is the background, and I think lots of your listeners would be familiar with it. But what I try to do in What the Hell Do You Have to Lose, Trump's War on Civil Rights, is go to the basics, again, back to the provisions you mentioned, the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and show how Trump administration policies are undermining the progress that we've made in this country over the last 50, 60 years on race relations.
And Juan, in your title, you don't imply a neglect of civil rights, which ironically President Obama was often accused of, not bringing up race enough, not being forceful enough in terms of issues that affect, in particular, the African American community. But you're saying Mr. Trump is actually been aggressive in a war against civil rights. So he's not doing this from a benign posture, a sort of laissez-faire posture. He's actually going after provisions of the Civil Rights Act of the 1960s, and really trying to roll back the clock.
Right. Well, I mean, the most, I think, familiar episode for your listeners, Tom, would be the Voting Rights Act, right? So, as you know, the Supreme Court had ruled that provisions of the Voting Rights Act were no longer relevant, and they thought it was outdated, and they wanted something new. The Congress has not acted. But here comes President Trump, and he starts a voter fraud commission, and there's no evidence that there was any voter fraud in the 2016 election, but he starts a voter fraud commission and then closes his eyes and the Justice Department eyes as we see new voter ID laws, we see new shifts in terms of access to polling places put in place by Republican majority legislatures around the country. All of this under the Trump administration, and in some cases going back and undoing efforts that were being put in place by the Obama administration to try to shore up insufficiencies in the current version, what we have left of the Voting Rights Act. So that's an example of how they're going after this kind of thing. But it extends into other areas, as you can see in the book. It extends into education, where efforts to bring more young people of color into America's colleges and universities have been reversed because they say, though this is affirmative action. Well, no, the schools were working with it. The government previously had been working with it, gone under the Trump administration. Similarly, if you look at something like economic development, housing development, community development block grants, community financing grants that were meant to encourage people to become entrepreneurs, now wiped away in this administration. I think you get the idea that in so many ways, this is an ongoing effort. By the way, one other that people often recognize is that under President Obama, you had Republicans on Capitol Hill working with the Justice Department on criminal justice reform, in particular going after mandatory minimums that are clogging the jails and putting people in there for relatively minor nonviolent offenses. But under the Trump administration and Attorney General Jeff Sessions, again, those efforts have been eliminated. So there is a marked and real difference in terms of race and efforts to ameliorate the damage done by our long, troubled history on race relations in this country. And it contributes to the idea that right now, more Americans than ever are saying, you know, I think it was 58% in a recent Fox poll, by the way, Tom, that said they disapprove of Trump's handling of race. That's sure. 58% is what I should say. And 55% said worse race relations are much worse under President Trump.
Juan Williams, the new book is called What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? Trump's War on Civil Rights. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. So, Juan, one of the things that struck me, and you mentioned the Voting Rights Act, which I suppose the crippling of the elimination of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which no longer required certain southern states to be approved by the Justice Department in Washington for any changes they wanted to make in the voting process. That in eliminating that provision, Justice Roberts belied a very different assumption about the status of African Americans in America today. He's basically saying in that decision that racism is gone, that it's no longer the problem that it was when the Voting Rights Act was enacted, and so therefore that provision is no longer necessary. Mr. Trump, on the other hand, during the campaign and continues to this day, to paint a very bleak picture, essentially projecting the plight of the black, what we might call, and you've called in your book, the black underclass, onto the entire community of African Americans across America. They, you know, I suppose you could put the problem with the Voting Rights Act as much at the feet of the Supreme Court as you can of Mr. Trump. But it's interesting that there's a dichotomy in their apparent worldviews about the status of black people in America. And you write a lot about this in the book.
This is fascinating, Tom. I really appreciate that, you know, sometimes you have an interviewer who has not read the book, much less understood it. So, Tom Hall, my hat's off to you. Thank you. But, yes, I mean, there is such a difference here, and I think part of it is the political advantage that Trump sees in painting Black America as a dystopia, as total chaos, as breaking apart. You know, the way that he presents it, what the hell do you have to lose, is condescending. I mean, it's like, you have nothing anyway. You all, speaking here of Blacks in particular, but I would extend it to Latinos, immigrants, you all live in bad neighborhoods, high levels of violence, bad schools, and no jobs. So what the hell do you have to lose? This is Trump's attitude. By the way, sharp contrast to the court saying, we have seen over the passage of the years, last 50 or 60 years, an improvement in terms of race relations in the country. And we now question whether some of the states that had previously been under the Voting Rights Act and, in, you know, like pre-clearance provisions for any changes in situation of polling places or rules about how late or early polling places open or where they're located. All of that, the court says, is showing improvement. And we think this act, the Voting Rights Act of 65, needs to be revised. Anyway, Trump is now presenting a very ugly image of Black America to his audiences. And remember, he doesn't say, what the hell do you have to lose, to a Black audience. He doesn't go into a Black neighborhood and say this. He says this at overwhelmingly, and I'm being kind because I could say all, white rallies in very suburban or rural areas of states. He first said this in Dimmondale, Michigan. Again, he didn't go into Detroit. He didn't go into Flint. He finds these areas with his supporters, overwhelmingly white, and says this. And the way it gets reported is interesting, Tom, because newspapers will say Trump's appeal to Black Americans. But I think that's a misconstruction. The fact is, he's telling this to whites in such a way as to say that chaos over there in the Black community is such that it's spreading. And these people are overly dependent on entitlement programs, therefore sapping your hard-earned tax dollars. And these people may want to mug you, attack you, even, you know, come in and ruin your good schools. And I, Donald Trump, I am the one, the hero, standing at the gate guarding against these barbarians. I would just point this out to you, Tom. The fact is 22% of Black America, which is, you know, it's almost double the percentage of Black Americans in the population, but 22% live in poverty, live in desperate situations in some cases. But the reality is also that 40% of Black America earns between $35,000 and $100,000 a year, 40%. An additional 12% earn between $100,000 and $200,000. In other words, a majority of Black Americans are either in the middle class or beyond the middle class in this country. The greatest achievement of the civil rights movement, going back to the days of Dr. King, the modern movement, 1954 to 1965, has been the emergence of a Black middle class in this country. And not only that, the emergence of Black political voice and power as represented by the election of the first Black president. There has been tremendous progress, tremendous shift in the last 50 years. And what we are seeing now is not only that Donald Trump ignores the presence and of the striving, achievement-oriented Black middle class in the country, but he in fact delights in the idea that there remains this hardcore of impoverished Blacks that he identifies as representing the entire Black population and a problem, therefore, for the white population of the country. Well, it's a problem for everyone, Black and white, but why he uses this to malign Black people and make them into the enemy as if they are dragging down the American dream can only be for one purpose, to advance himself politically by scaring his supporters into believing that they're under attack.
Man, you make some interesting points about some very prominent Black intellectuals, particularly Ta-Nehisi Coates, who in certain ways sort of buy into that very notion. We're going to talk about that when we come back in just a little bit. And Juan, I need to beg your indulgence here while we take care of a little business. Juan Williams is a host and analyst on the Fox News Channel. We're talking about his latest book. It's called What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? Trump's War on Civil Rights. We'll have more with Juan Williams in just a bit. You are welcome to join our conversation, 410-666. 662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @midday_WYPR. But before we get back to talking about this book, we need to take a minute to remind you that this is our fall membership campaign. We are very grateful to everybody who has stepped up and decided to become a member to continue, perhaps even increase your sustaining membership. Thank you, Andy, and thanks again to everybody who has made a pledge in this, our fall membership campaign. We really appreciate it. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, during Midday, as Andy mentioned, we will be bringing you, it looks like, live coverage of the Brett Kavanaugh hearing on Capitol Hill. At this point, we expect that Dr. Christine Blasey Ford and Judge Kavanaugh will appear before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And if you've been following this story, you know that things may change between now and then. But at this point, we are planning to carry NPR's live coverage and provide analysis and reaction here in Studio A as well as from NPR. And by the way, on Friday, my guest will be Dr. Carol Anderson of Emory University. She has written a very important book about voting. It's called One Person, No Vote: How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. That's coming up Friday here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest this hour is Juan Williams, a journalist who's been covering race and politics in our country for four decades and whose career has encompassed positions with The Washington Post and NPR. He's a host and analyst on the Fox News Channel and a columnist for The Hill. His latest book is called What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? Trump's War on Civil Rights. And as you've heard, if you were with us for the first segment of the show, he also takes up the notion of voting and voting rights. If you'd like to join our conversation with Juan Williams, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday_WYPR. And if you want to catch me on Twitter, you can follow me @TomHallWYPR. So, Juan, I mentioned before the break, folks like Ta-Nehisi Coates, that you assert, in a way, buys into this notion that Mr. Trump has, that the failings of the black underclass are indicative of the black community at large. One of the things that appears to have happened in the election in 2016 is that somehow the black middle class was decoupled from the white middle class. And when people talked about this white disgruntled, often rural or, suburban, male, often male, but women too, who were disgruntled, felt marginalized, felt ignored, they, migrated to the Trump campaign rather than the Clinton campaign. Mr. Trump did in fact, score better with black voters, by a margin of about 2 more points than Mitt Romney had, in the previous election. What do you think? I mean, this uptick of support among the blacks to the Trump philosophy or the Trump pitch, what accounts for that? And what accounts for black intellectuals like Mr. Coates and others who do you really think they're sort of unwittingly buying into Mr. Trump's notion of what it means to be black in America today?
Well, Tom, I think the context is a little different. I think Ta-Nehisi Coates, for example, and a lot of actually black public intellectuals, civil rights leaders, want to concentrate America's attention on people who have been left behind, especially in an era of growing income inequality that now exacerbates that divide. Because if you start with a high percentage of black people who remain in poverty, and then you have an overall growth in terms of economic divide in the society, it does compound the problem in black America. And so they are being very much aware of people who are continuing to live desperate lives and saying, hey, we Americans have to deal with our original sin and its aftermath. So we have to deal with the original sin, of course, being slavery, but then also legal segregation, ongoing bias and discrimination, lack of economic, but also, I think, on a more basic level, lack of educational opportunity for so many. And they're saying, hey, we need to lift these people up and not forget about them. But Donald Trump and the Trump campaign took that same message in a different context and used it, I think, to scare people, especially white people who live out in the distant rural areas or even in some cases in suburban areas, by playing to racial division in society. The Russians, I think, had the same theory, by the way, from all that we know about the Russian hacking and Russian bots interfering in the 2016 race, they were trying to exacerbate the differences, the tensions in society, but specifically the racial differences. So when Trump was talking about the black poor, he's not saying, oh, yeah, well, there's some people who have been left behind and we need to help them. He's saying there's some people who've been left behind who are undeserving. And this is something that's recently been focused on by academics. I saw a study the other day that said that so many of the Trump supporters had the belief that undeserving groups were getting ahead of them. They weren't being paid attention to. And again, it plays into the Trump theme that especially white men in like the coal industry, the mining industry, the gas industry, the oil industry, that these people were forgotten in America, that the first black president, Barack Obama, or his former Secretary of State and the Democratic nominee in 2016, Hillary Clinton, had no sympathy or understanding for them. And in fact, they would argue that those folks were being plied with identity politics, Obama and Clinton, that they played identity politics appealing to blacks, Latinos, to Asians, to women on the basis of their race or gender, while the hardworking whites in the society were being neglected. And this message did resonate with so many Trump supporters.
Juan Williams, his latest book is called What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? Trump's War on Civil Rights. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Our number here, 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wypr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter. And Juan, you know, last week I spoke with Doris Kearns Goodwin, who's got a new book about leadership. And she examines the careers of four presidents, four people who she's studied throughout her career: Abraham Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson. And she says that one of the things, the commonalities that these great leaders all shared was a deep sense of empathy for others. And you write, right in the introduction to your book, that Mr. Trump's apparent distaste for black people really is tied to his lack of empathy for virtually everybody, but particularly the poor. I mean, you mentioned the birther movement. Even before that, there was the Central Park Five affair in New York, in which Mr. Trump was very much an outspoken critic of these young kids who turned out to be found not guilty ultimately. Is empathy really at the heart of his racism? And then let me ask you about that word and about whether or not racism is the and racist is the way we should be describing this president.
Well, I think that there's a clear lack of compassion. I don't think this is anything to do with compassion. It has to do with antagonism, and I think pushing the fair button in my mind. It's so easy to identify the other in American society, Tom, because we are a racial mix and we're becoming more mixed. Remember, at this juncture as we're talking, Latinos are the biggest minority group in the country, and that's a big jump from where we were historically. For most of our history, blacks have been the biggest minority group in the country. So now you have about 13% of the country as black. You have about 16-17% as Latino. By the way, the fastest growing Asian, now up to about 5-7% of the country. And in terms of people who are foreign born immigrants, we are now near to the historical peak in American society, approaching 15%. So if you are suffering economically at this moment, and as I just want to reiterate, a moment when we have a growing income divide in the country, you have people who are going to say, it's that guy's fault. It's the fault of the other. And I think President Trump succeeded in his campaign in, again, dividing us by objectifying the newcomers, and in particular people of color, as the cause of someone else's economic distress, or, as studies have suggested, saying that the government and the likes of Obama and Clinton and the Democrats is all about helping these newcomers or these poor people, but not about helping you, hardworking, middle-class, working-class man in specific. I think that's a total lack of compassion. It's all about fear.
And you quote a Reuters poll, which found that 39, and this is just from last year, this is 2017, 39% of Americans believe that whites are currently under attack in this country. And one of the conversations I have with an awful lot of folks on this show and elsewhere And you quote, again, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who says, not every Trump voter is a white supremacist, just as not every white person in the Jim Crow South was a white supremacist, but every Trump voter felt it was acceptable to hand the fate of the country over to one. This distinction between Mr. Trump's racism and the, in some quarters, the assumed racism of anybody who voted for him, where do you come down on that?
Well, again, you know, we can go back to the poll numbers, Tom, because we had a poll that, in fact, just recently indicated that there's an astonishing number of people who think that President Trump is a racist. That if you were to ask them, I think it's now like 49% say that Trump, and this includes, by the way, 11% of Republicans, Trump is a racist. This was a Quinnipiac poll done this summer. And 22% of Republicans told Quinnipiac the president has, and here I'm quoting, emboldened people who hold racist beliefs to express those beliefs publicly. We know about people like David Duke and, you know, the former head of the Klan saying that he supports Donald Trump. We know about the neo-Nazis and the white nationalists who marched in Charlottesville saying that they felt empowered by Donald Trump. And even when they were called on the carpet after the death of the young woman, run over by one of the neo-Nazis, and Trump said, find people on both sides, they were saying, thank God for Mr. Trump. So they do feel emboldened. But again, it's not just Juan Williams saying this.
Well, what about the person then who says, okay, may say out loud, oh, I abhor that. I abhor those remarks after Charlottesville. However, I support what Mr. Trump is doing with tax cuts. I support what Mr. Trump is doing with his nominees to the Supreme Court. I support what Mr. Trump is doing with his efforts to deregulate the EPA and other agencies of the government. Is a vote for a person who says those things at Charlottesville because you're a voter who celebrates what Mr. Trump is doing in other areas, is that indicative of racism on the part of that voter?
Let me begin. I will answer your question in a second, but let me just say this up front, that for those folks, then, the key point to my mind, and in this book, What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? Trump's War on Civil Rights, is that they are willing to treat Trump's racism, even as they acknowledge it, right? Half of the country acknowledges, 11% of Republicans say the man's a racist. They're willing to treat that as a mere flip. You know, something yeah. like, you know, a distraction for snowflakes who are too PC and overly sensitive, and then go ahead and say, but we support him because of these other policies, because we think the EPA may be overreaching, or because we want more assistance for the coal mining industry. Somehow, the idea that the person who's our leader is racist and engaged in racist behavior, if not, you know, if his words aren't bad enough, it's okay. That why are you guys so concerned about this? You're the ones who are playing identity politics by always harping on this and bringing up the race card. And that's the way the conversation goes, Tom. And so it's kind of befuddling to me. How can good people, and remember, 90% of Republicans support President Trump. So how can good people, people of conscience, somehow say, it doesn't matter that I am belittling and demonizing those people of color in American society and immigrants who have made America great for all of our history. I'm going to demonize all of them, but because I kind of like this guy and his populist, high energy language and thoughts, and don't worry about what he has to say. Well, I'm telling you, in this book, I document that it goes far beyond what he has to say in terms of looking at what he is doing.
Juan Williams is the author of What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? Trump's War on Civil Rights. We'll have more with Juan when we continue. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle @midday WYPR. We have Jay waiting on the line. We have an email from Michelle that we're going to get to right when we come back. But first, I want to throw it back to Andy Bienstock, and we want to talk about how this very well could be the last, it certainly will be the last full day of our fundraising for this fall membership campaign because of coverage we're going to bring you tomorrow. We're planning to bring you tomorrow of the Kavanaugh hearings with the Senate Judiciary Committee.
In less than 2 years, My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. America's so true. Didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay.
Well, on the day when a famous comedian, Bill Cosby, went to jail, Donald Trump tried a little line that he didn't realize was going to be taken as very funny at the United Nations. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. If you've just joined us, we're talking about the civil rights record of President Donald Trump from the moment he announced his candidacy for president in the summer of 2015 to his establishment of a commission to look into voting fraud that was not supported by any credible evidence to his widely condemned comments following the violence in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. Mr. Trump is the first president in modern history to, in word and in deed, display unmistakable bias against people of color. Now, if you don't think that characterization is accurate, or if you do think that it does accurately describe the president, we'd love to hear from you. My guest this hour is Juan Williams of the Fox News Channel. He's a veteran political journalist, a columnist, and commentator. He's written many books about the American civil rights movement, including the companion book to the documentary series Eyes on the Prize. His latest book, released just yesterday, is called What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? Trump's War on Civil Rights. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can also find us on Twitter. Juan, we heard from Michelle via email, who says, how much of Trump's actions can be attributed to his wanting to stem the growth of the number of people of color in America, to keep it from becoming majority non-white, or at least making sure that if the growth continues, people of color will be under siege? I mean, the latest actions that the Trump administration has taken at the southern border, again, all part of a piece of the kinds of things that you're writing about in this book.
Well, I think that's right. And so I'm very interested in Michelle's question, because one of the consistent lines of thought that I come across in Trump supporters is, you know, these immigrants, these blacks, these Latinos and Asians, they vote Democratic. So why should we be welcoming these people? This is a plot by the Democrats. And I mean, they go much farther. Obviously, they want to say that the Democrats are for open borders because Democrats question the efficacy of a wall and what it would actually accomplish. But the idea is somehow that this is a political fight, that it would further diminish the power of Republicans if we, in fact, somehow open the doors on a legal basis to resolving the presence of 12 million illegal immigrants in the country. That this is a political issue. They don't want to deal with the morality or even the consciousness at stake in terms of saying this is how we deal with others in American society, and our history is one, I would argue, of having to come to terms not only with slavery, but with lines of demarcation that were set between the, you know, first it was the Irish, the Italians, the Jews, and trying to all of us become one out of many, e pluris unum, you know, I mean, to go back to that idea. But again, I just wanted to signal to you, Tom, that for many people, again, the whole notion of race, racism, of supporting the notion that, you know, people are being called names, oh, it's not really the issue. The real issue to them is, oh, those people vote Democratic.
Let's go to the phones. Jay in Bel Air, thanks for your patience. Welcome to Midday with Juan Williams.
Oh, thanks for having me. Mr. Williams, a privilege to talk to you. Huge fan. Didn't think I would actually get a chance to talk to you. I just want to talk briefly just about, focus on basically the title of the book and what you were talking about before, is when Donald Trump said, what the hell you have to lose. And I just sort of like to focus on the messenger. Being Donald Trump being the person that was saying that, and I think most people agree that he's not the most warm and fuzzy individual out there. When he's made that statement, it may not be taken best coming from him, but most people that I personally know of color do have issues with racial injustice in this country, and a myriad of different types of injustice. I can't even get into them all. And I just think that if it came from a different source, would we be questioning what he said? it, for example, if it had been, and I'll use the opposite of the spectrum, if Cory Booker was running for office, he said, hey, what do we have to lose? Vote for me. Would we be saying, oh, how could he say that? Look how good things are. I don't think we would.
No, right, Jay, I think you're right. I think you're right, Bob. I think that, again, this is what I was saying to Tom. I think the context matters greatly. So if it was Cory Booker, or even if it had been, let's say, President Obama, but I would argue that even people, you know, just going back, Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, Al Gore, I think that they had a relationship with the black community, with the Latino community, that was stronger and was not about alarming the white community and saying, hey, oh my gosh, look at this dysfunction over here, and it's spreading, and it could infect you, and it could impact your opportunities and your children's opportunities to get into school, or, you know, it's going to put more pressure on the public budget, which is going to drive up your taxes, and it's these people they're doing. Yeah, I think that's right. So if Booker said it, if Obama said it, Kamala Harris in this, you know, in this go around as we approach the 2020 race, I think it has a different impact. It's not about scaring anybody, and it's not about dividing us. It's about reminding us that we still have people who have tremendous needs in American society. Again, I just go back, I don't want to bore you, but I mean, I said to Tom before, this is a time of growing income inequality. So when you're talking about knowing people who are, in fact, in need of some assistance, I think that that's compassionate. That's, you're very aware, and I'm glad that you have a sense of people in our world who can use a hand up. But it's not to suggest that they are criminal in every case. It's not to suggest that they're lacking any desire or ambition. It's not to suggest that they're not patriotic. These are Americans. These are our fellow Americans, and their fate is directly intertwined with all of us, whether we are black, white, Asian, Hispanic. And I think Trump doesn't have that consciousness, doesn't have that approach, and that's why the words coming from him have a very different impact.
Stephanie emails us, Debbie first. We'll get to Debbie's email, who asked, do you have a statistic for the percentage of Americans in general who live in poverty? My understanding, Juan, is it's about 13%, although, for
Correct.
Example, here in Baltimore, it's up as high as 25% living below the poverty line, and these are mostly people of color living in our city. But Debbie says, I'm shocked daily by the behavior of young people in my own family with regard to this president's rhetoric. They believe everything they see on Facebook. Let me talk about that, about media literacy. You work for a network that an awful lot of folks think of as a mouthpiece for Donald Trump. What are the difficulties, if there are any, that you encounter working for Fox News in the current media environment, when Fox News is so much representative of an extreme view of this administration and of the world in general, and is often put in direct contrast with other mainstream news organizations?
Well, I don't think there's any question that President Trump has an intimate relationship with Fox News, in particular some of our key primetime voices. Sean Hannity, for example, stands out. I mean, he's very much close to the president and very much trumpeting everything that the president does and attacking the president's critics, even attacking Robert Mueller and the Russia probe. So I think that, you know, the email is exactly on target. Now, for me, the key point is that Fox is the number one cable network in America, and I'm in the fight. So I'm there every day. I am there. No one's telling me what to say. I'm able to challenge perspectives. I'm on the air every day on The 5, which is at 5 p.m. Eastern. But I'm also on many of the primetime shows and the news shows, and I'm there when we have major events like political conventions, elections, and the like. And again, it's, to me, important that somebody be engaged, because otherwise, well, then I think we all just go deeper into our bubbles. So for me, I get beat up sometimes. I can show you scars, Tom. I mean, things that I don't like. Right. But I just think it's so valuable that at least there is some different point of view being expressed. And I think that, for me, it's not always comfortable. But as I said, no one's telling me what to say. No one is shutting me up. No one is excluding me. Sometimes I feel like people are talking past me or imagining that, well, yeah, I heard you, but I don't think it's as important. As I was saying to you earlier, so many people think, oh, don't be a snowflake. Don't be overly sensitive and PC. That's just Trump being Trump, you know, the bully boy, the bullying language. But actually, he doesn't really think that way. But in fact, I think he does think that way, and that's why I felt compelled to write this book.
Juan Williams, he's the co-host of The Five and a commentator on the Fox News Channel, as you've just heard. His new book is called What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? Trump's War on Civil Rights. Juan Williams has joined us today from the studios of WABE in Atlanta. Juan, great to talk to you. Thank you so much, and congratulations on the book.
Tom, thank you, and thanks for a fine interview. I really appreciate it.
Me too. That's it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to carry NPR's live coverage of the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing with Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and at least one of the women who have stepped forward in recent days to accuse Judge Kavanaugh of sexual misconduct. That will probably air during our midday time, but we will be here to have analysis and appraisal of what happens. Dr. Christine Blasey Ford is also scheduled to testify tomorrow. Lunch today provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street over in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. More information on the web at dangerouspiesbalt.com. So before we leave you today, we want to take another couple of minutes to thank everybody who has contributed in our fall membership campaign so far and to encourage everybody else who hasn't to join them in supporting your public radio. Here's Andy Bienstock to tell you how easy it is to do just that.